Good day, care team. Hey, this is one of those days where unfortunately I can't be with you live to do Andy's Open Door. So instead of having a guest host, we decided to show a video. And this is a talk I gave recently for the Portland Chamber of Commerce at an event called Eggs and Issues, where I had the opportunity to present to a large group of regional business leaders. I'm going to talk about some of the challenges that we face in healthcare globally, as well as here specifically at Maine Health. I'm also going to talk about how we're thinking about solving some of those challenges and how we're tying that to our vision of working together so our communities are the healthiest in America. My hope is you'll get some insight into how our business operates, some of the challenges we are facing, and how we can all work together to overcome them. While I give this talk, I want to point out an error that I made. I referenced an internal ambulance service that we've created, and I mentioned that we spent $8 million in capital, which is true. I also mentioned that it's projected to lose $10 million a year in operating expense, which is not correct. It's actually $2 million, and so I wanted to take this opportunity to correct that before you see that in the video. Well, here we go. I hope you find this useful, and we'll be back with you live next time.
Bridging gaps, building partnerships. Please welcome to the stage Maine Health CEO, Dr. Andy Muller.
Good morning. It's great to be with all of you this morning. And on behalf of Maine Health, I want to start with just thoughts for those of you who are impacted by yesterday's weather personally or whose businesses were impacted, certainly thinking about all of you. It's great to be with you today. And as we, you know, start talking about this, you know, it really does revolve around working together so our communities are the healthiest in America. I remember the first time I read those words. I was the CEO of a smaller health system in Virginia, and I had just gotten a phone call about the opportunity to potentially come join the Maine Health team. And when I started my healthcare career, I was a practicing family physician. I feel like I accidentally got engaged in leadership somehow, some way, and really enjoyed the challenges that leadership presented, and found myself continuing to advance and take on more responsibility. And one day woke up and saw that I had contributed meaningfully to the irrational overinvestment in healthcare services for precisely two-thirds of the community we serve. And you can probably imagine what the one-third of the community looked like that was a healthcare desert. And I just thought to myself, there has to be another way. And so that led me to the health system in Virginia. And when I saw, you know, first got the phone call about Maine Health, the one thing that I knew about Maine Health, having spent most of my life in the southeastern United States, was Maine Health's reputation for quality and safety. That was the first thing that I thought about and that allowed me to continue the discussion with the recruiter. As I began to research the organization, the vision statement of working together so our communities are the healthiest in America was awfully compelling. But that's not what really hooked my heart. What really got me so excited about the opportunity to join the Maine Health team was beginning to understand that it had done so much to put that vision into action, with meaningful investments around building public health infrastructure, around really connecting with communities, around doing lots of things that don't necessarily generate a return on investment, aren't designed to drive things like market share, things that were important in a past life that I participated in. Maine Health just wasn't that kind of healthcare system. And I think to this day, many of you who've lived exclusively in the state of Maine probably aren't aware of what a special organization Maine Health has been for decades. It's a different kind of healthcare system. That's what got me so excited about coming to Maine and being a part of the Maine Health team. So what is Maine Health? So Maine Health is 9 acute care hospitals Eight of those are in the state of Maine. One of those is in Carroll County, New Hampshire. It's 250 physician practices. It's a big laboratory company. It's education with a jointly ventured medical school with Tufts University, and 18 residency programs, 15 fellowship programs, a research institute. It's all of those things. But really, what Maine Health is, it's people. Just like you, just like me, your neighbors, the spouses and partners of your employees, your family members, all with hopes and dreams and fears and aspirations, all of whom are passionately motivated around the thought of helping others and around achieving that vision of working together so our communities are the healthiest in America. And it's been a hard, hard road for them over the last few years. You know, the pandemic was scary, and it had a big impact on our workforce. And it's easy now. So I spoke to a few people in the audience this morning who recently had COVID. And what was that like? Well, I was tired for a few days. I had a little bit of a scratchy throat and got over it. And it's so easy to forget what it was like a few years ago when we were getting reports out of China that the workforce mortality rate from contracting COVID was between 6 and 7%. Think about what it would feel like if you thought that you had a 1 in 20 chance of dying by going to work. Think about what impact that would have on your workforces during that period of time. But that's where our workforce was up against. It was arduous, it was scary, and it was hard. And many decided during that period of time that maybe it was time to retire, or maybe it was time to do something else. Or maybe it was time to reconsider whether they wanted to have that type of career moving forward. And that's impacted us all with a huge workforce shortage that still lingers today. And when you think about the impact of that, particularly given the needs of where our country is going, the estimates are to fill the workforce void that we've got in healthcare, 3 out of every 4 new entrants into the job market over the next 10 years would need to choose a healthcare career. Now, how likely is that? It's not, which tells you what we're up against moving forward. In addition to that, we began to see that so many patients were either unable to get care, were frightened to get care, or frankly began losing trust in healthcare and deferred care. And we're still feeling the impact of all of that deferred care coming to us. Some of it was deferred preventive care. Some of it was much more advanced care that's needed for those individuals. And we're still feeling the burden and the impact of that today. And then the other thing that has really impacted our people as we think about how we continue to attract, how we retain, how we continue to create the type of workforce that all of you are going to want to deliver the care that you need, is that in the early days of the pandemic, they were revered as heroes, as they are. But times have changed dramatically, and so one of the big investments we're making at Maine Health are putting barriers in place, both physical as well as training, to keep our workforce safe from violence. You would be absolutely blown away with the number of incidents of violence against our workforce that occur every day. And so people are no longer scared of contracting COVID at work, but they are absolutely scared of leaving at the end of the day with broken bones, bites, head injuries, and other trauma, in addition to feeling the effects of verbal abuse that occur constantly in our healthcare system. I don't think I ever dreamed as a healthcare leader that we would be so focused on doing everything we can just to protect the physical wellness of our workforce against violence, but that's where we are today. So it's been a tough journey for our care team, and we're doing a lot of things to continue to support them, to continue to make the workforce better. And we've made great progress. We set out to achieve a goal of having top quartile industry best turnover as a healthcare system over the next 5 years. We launched that goal just over a year ago. We actually achieved that last year. And in fact, we did it by reducing our turnover rate by about 14%. But the most recent data shows that we've actually done it by over 20%. We're one of the best in the country now at retaining the workforce that we attract. So we're making good progress. This shows you the impact of our business over the last few years in healthcare delivery. And the story you're seeing up here is similar to many, but not all, healthcare systems across the country. And I want to highlight a couple of things for you. One is you're going to see on your left side a dotted line on that graph that represents a 3% operating margin. And that 3% operating margin is there because that's what we have voluntarily restricted ourselves to as a healthcare system for years. Many years ago, the Dirigo Act was passed in Maine that asked healthcare systems to voluntarily restrict themselves to that operating margin, which is something we've done. And it's interesting because I turned on the car radio about a year or so ago, and I was listening to Marketplace on National Public Radio, and they're doing a series on how businesses make money. And Kai Rizdahl, the commentator, got on and said, imagine going into a business that generates only a 3% operating margin. Who in the world would ever elect to do that? It was a story about grocery stores, because that's what they do. And if Mike or the team from Hannaford or Shaw's are here today, we're with you, right there with you. That's hard. That's a hard business, but that's what we do at Maine Health. I was just at a conference where a number of healthcare systems were reporting their financial earnings. Some of the very large ones and some that are in really good neighborhoods, some of the large ones, some of the for-profits, we're talking about margins of 7-8%. I was part of a healthcare system involved in a very competitive market. We would routinely see margins in the 5-6% range. Maine Health has never been one of those healthcare systems, and it won't be as long as I'm the CEO. There are healthcare systems, not-for-profit healthcare system, that have fleets of corporate planes, they have luxury boxes at pro sporting events. Maine Health is not that kind of healthcare system, and it won't be that kind of healthcare system while I'm the CEO. So we've averaged a little bit less than that, as you can see, over the last 4 years, and we've not recovered our operating margin since the pandemic hit. We are hopeful that we can break even this year, but even as we budgeted to break even this year, we recognized we needed to make even bigger investments in our workforce, especially our physicians and APPs, our advanced practice providers, our nurse practitioners, physician assistants, who are still struggling to figure out how to cope in this new reality that we face. As you can see on the right side of the slide, one of the things that has really impacted us is the cost of temporary labor. And this is something that really began to emerge as the workforce began to shrink. And we had greater needs to provide care, particularly for sick COVID patients, during the second wave of the pandemic when that really hit in 2022. And it wasn't that we were asleep at the wheel. You can see that historically, as like most health systems, we had a fair amount of temporary labor because that's helpful. It prevents us from having to lay people off when times get slow, and it helps us flex our workforce in a very appropriate manner. But after what happened between 2020 and 2021, where we saw it almost double to 2% of our operating margin, we decided to go crazy. We decided, look, we know it's going to continue to get worse, so we're actually going to double that to 4%. And boy, were we wrong. It went up to 8% of our operating margin. Think about trying to overcome that in a given year. It's a real challenge. Now, it has come back down, and it has come back down with a lot of concerted energy and effort around managing our labor better and more effectively. And it has come down a little bit because the rates of travel labor have come down somewhat. Now, I would love to tell you that the slope of that line between those 2 years is going to continue, and just in a few years, we're going to be out of this labor crisis. But you heard what I said earlier. That's not going to be the case. We're going to be stuck with this labor crisis for the foreseeable future. It's not going to go away. Now, in addition to that, we are doing everything we possibly can to continue to grow our healthcare workforce here in Maine. We're partnering with institutions just like the University of Southern Maine, like the University of New England, Husson, St. Joseph's, our community college systems, with unique partnerships to try to encourage more students. We're even doing things like creating certified medical assistant programs where those students actually get paid to go to class to make the education affordable, and we're funding that to ensure that's happening. But while the workforce challenge has hit us at Maine Health, our partners in delivering healthcare aren't immune either. So we've seen a near collapse of our post-acute care facilities, our skilled nursing facilities, which is putting additional pressure on all of us. On any given day, we have roughly 100 or so patients at Maine Medical Center, effectively 15% of the capacity, that are really nursing home patients that we can't send anywhere. We're effectively repurposing this scarce resource for something it's not intended to be, that limits our ability to gain access for more patients who have acute needs that we need to treat. And of course, we don't get paid for providing that care. Sometimes for lengths of over 100 days, we have patients in our facilities who don't need to be in the hospital. We get paid for any of that. But we still got to provide all of that care and support as the infrastructure around us is suffering and struggling. In addition to that, I'll tell you a story. I was rounding at one of our hospitals up in Belfast, Waldo County General, and I was on the second floor talking to a nurse. It was a Friday afternoon, and I could see that she was really upset. So I asked her what was going on, and she said, we have this really sick patient who's got a terrible heart condition, and she really needs to be at Maine Medical Center. But we can't find a single ambulance anywhere in the state that can transport her. We have seen a significant decline in the number of paramedics and ambulances that our local services are able to provide to move those patients. We actually had a serious conversation around, could I put this patient in my car and drive her back to Maine Medical Center? It was a little bit of a ludicrous idea in retrospect, but we were desperate in the moment. Fortunately, the patient was ultimately able to get there and had a good outcome. But that's not to say that there weren't others who were put in harm's way. So we made the investment of $10 million of capital to buy more ambulances and have built an intra-hospital transport services that we expect to lose $8 million a year. That's the reality of what we face, and we feel like we have to do that because we are that kind of healthcare system. And as you think about running your own businesses, and let's just say like tennis shoes aren't selling well, and you're losing money on the tennis shoe line of business, well, it might make good sense to say, you know, we're just not going to be in the tennis shoe business anymore. We could erase our losses instantly and put ourselves back on good financial footing if we just stop providing behavioral health services. But we can't do that. Our chief medical officer recently joined our organization, came from an organization that did that. It's part of the reason he left. They actually stopped behavioral health services so they could maintain a margin well above 3%. But Maine Health has never been that kind of healthcare system, nor will we be. That's part of the reason he joined Maine Health, because he could see our commitment to our communities, our patients, and in always trying to do the right thing. So those are some of the challenges that we're going to continue to face. So this slide's interesting. If you look at the top line, it shows you the consumer price index over the last few years. The bottom line shows you physician reimbursement for Medicare over that same period of time. If you actually take it back and extrapolate back to the year 2000, relative to inflation, physician payments have effectively undergone a 26% decline over that period of time. Think about some of your key lines in your businesses if you suffered that type of loss over that period of time. It has been stated repeatedly that, you know, part of what health systems like Maine Health have done is gobbled up physician practices strategically to create leverage. The reality, I think, is far from that. The reality is that without organizations like MaineHealth making an investment in physician practices, we would have severely fewer physicians and APPs in practice in our communities today. This has been about preserving those practices, particularly in our rural communities. There has been a lot of talk about consolidation in healthcare and what that means. And I just want to present some context for all of you because I think it's really important. Most of the discussion has been around how rampant consolidation in healthcare delivery has driven up the cost of healthcare. And you can find data to support that. You can also find plenty of data to refute that. But let me give you some perspective on what consolidation looks like. Providing healthcare services is a $1.4 trillion industry. If you take the five largest healthcare systems across the country, that's four not-for-profits and one for-profit healthcare system, and combine them, their total combined market share is 1.7%. If you look on the health insurance side of the equation, the top five health insurance companies in America represent 70% of the commercial insurance. So I would argue there has been rampant consolidation in healthcare, but it's not on the delivery side. It's on the health insurance side. So just to repeat that, 1.7% for the top five healthcare delivery systems in the country. The top five insurance companies represent 70% of the commercial market share. Vastly different. Now, we are a big organization. We have a top line revenue of $4 billion. That wonderful care team I told you about is massive. It's 23,000 individuals who make up the MaineHealth team. We're the largest private employer in the state. So by Maine standards, we are large. But to give you, again, further context, when you compare us to the large health insurance organizations, Elevance, formerly known as Anthem, recorded revenue last year of $169 billion. It's 43 times our size. You want to talk really big, United Healthcare generated revenue the same period last year of $360 billion. 90 times our size. Many of you may not be aware that all of the healthcare insurance companies are also getting into the delivery side. They're actually beginning to now compete against us, which makes our struggles even that much greater. There are roughly 600,000 physicians in America. One in 10 is employed by United Healthcare. They're the largest employer of physicians in the country. There are another 30,000 who have a relationship with them, and a total of 120,000 physicians and APPs who are either employed or have a contractual relationship with United Healthcare. That's the changing landscape that's occurring. So people talk about the leverage we have as a healthcare system, as MaineHealth. I just want to kind of give you a sense of the magnitude of the gradients that actually exist in our industry. Now, this slide's a bit complicated, I admit, but it kind of gives you a sense of how we have to think about our business. So the left side of the screen shows you our payer mix by payer. And you can see Medicare is by far and away the dominant payer which we receive funding from. And if you add that to Medicaid, the government is by and far our largest source of payment. Now, when you look at the payment relative to cost, you can see a couple of things that occur. Medicare and Medicaid don't really meet the cost to deliver the care that we deliver. And I would say that while we are not the least expensive healthcare system based on costs, our costs are pretty moderate when you look at the Medicare database around what our costs look like. We're fairly pretty much typical, middle of the road type of healthcare system from that standpoint. We still have work to do for sure. And you can see that we overcharge commercial insurance to fill the gap. Now, that may come as a surprise to some of you, but it actually really shouldn't, because believe it or not, that's exactly how the system was designed. When the Medicare Act was passed in 1965, this was the intent. The government sources of payment would never cover the full cost of care, and the rest would come effectively as a tax on employers. And that's the cost shifting. This is the first cost shift we'll talk about that impacts that care. Now, I don't love this, to be honest with you. I think it's kind of silly. I don't love fee-for-service payments. I think in some ways they're kind of perverse, but it is where we're at today. And I think we have opportunities as a community to rethink some of that around how we can do things a little bit differently as we move forward. Now, there are a number of things that I think are important for us to consider when we talk about this cost shift and how it impacts how we think about the cost of care. One is, if you're in a state that happens to have a higher proportion of Medicare eligible beneficiaries, then you're forced to shift more than a state that has a lower proportion of Medicare beneficiaries. The two states we operate in, Maine and New Hampshire, have the relatively oldest populations in the United States. And so we do cost shift more in Maine. That's not a reflection of our cost, it's a reflection of our demographics. And so one of the ways that we can provide relief to those of you who are bearing the brunt of this, and listen, we're an employer too, we bear the brunt of it as well. Our healthcare spend on our own care team, our 36,000 care team members and their dependents, is $250 million a year. It's real money to us as well. One of the ways we do that is we start to change the demographics of the state. We've got to continue to focus on recruitment of a talented young workforce into the state to support us. And that's not just to help reduce the cost of health insurance on the commercial side for all of us, it's to actually deliver healthcare. So one of the dirty little secrets that no one seems to be talking about that we've got to talk about more is that in the United States of America, by the year 2035, there will be nearly 100 million adults over the age of 65. Think about that. There are going to be more adults over the age of 65 than there are going to be Americans under the age of 18. There will be roughly 156 million working adults, which means that the ratio of working adults to those who are eligible for Medicare and Social Security is going to be around 2-to-1. When these programs were conceived, the ratio was around 4.5-to-1. How are we going to support that? Not just in terms of costs, but how are we going to support that in terms of a workforce to deliver all that care? Heck, I'll be approaching 65 around those times. Who's going to take care of me when that occurs? We've got to be thinking about that. And that's only going to be worse in our state because of the demographics. And so we've got a real challenge as we think about that. Now, there are a lot of things that we are doing to try to improve the situation here, particularly around cost, which is hard. So healthcare has historically been largely a pass-through business. These are the expenses that we face. We pass this on to our customers. We get fixed payment from Medicare. And while, yes, the Medicare reimbursement for hospitals is better than it has been for physicians, it's only marginally better. We've seen increases of about 2% the last couple of years, despite what you understand inflation looks like, particularly around the job market for us. And so we've been pressed on all of those fronts. But at the same time, we're not that kind of healthcare system. We have been working hard to figure out ways not to pass all of those costs on to our employers and our community, because we need you all to be successful. We need your businesses to grow. We need you to hire more people. We need you to be attractive and bring more people into Maine to help us solve some of those problems in the future. So with a lot of hard work and determination, we reduced our costs last year by $92 million. Now, that's hard because in healthcare, you can pretty much count on 60% of our costs are labor. So it is hard to reduce those non-labor expenses. And if we reduce labor, the reality is that we're going to have to talk about reducing services. And that's something we don't want to do. We're already starting to face healthcare deserts in our state, and we don't want to contribute to that. Nor do we want to take away jobs from our employees, because many of the communities we serve, we are the largest employer. and those employees are married to some of your employees, and they shop in your stores, and they bank in your banks, and they do those kind of things. So we want to keep them meaningfully employed. So we've done everything we can not to reduce services and to ensure that we've got a workforce out there that can continue to contribute to the economy. And that self-serving, to be perfectly transparent with you, because we know there's good data that shows that longevity is most closely associated with two critically important vital signs, your zip code and your credit score. The economy of a community ultimately drives and impacts the health of a community. So if we're going to achieve our vision of working together so our communities are the healthiest in America, then we need a robust economy here in the state of Maine. In order to continue to realize cost benefit, we've got to do incredibly difficult and hard things, and that includes changing the way we deliver care. And that's hard. It's hard having conversations with a physician who's been doing the same thing for 25 years and now telling them we've got to think about how we do it differently. Those are difficult conversations, but those are ones that we're engaging with to figure out how we can improve our bottom line while at the same time continuing to improve the level of care that we deliver for the community, because you all deserve that. And it's also why we need flexibility in thinking about how we utilize our workforce for the future. And that's why we struggle with arbitrary staffing ratios like the proposed nurse staffing ratio bill, which is going to hold us to a standard that's largely unachievable here in the state of Maine. The Maine Nursing Board has been perfectly clear. There are not tens of thousands of nurses waiting to come back on the sidelines in the state, that just aren't. And if that bill that's before the legislature right now passes, it's going to add another $37 million of expense to our system unless we reduce our workforce and reduce services, and that's what we're up against. Additionally, that Medicare number that we have there, that 76%, that's not like that's the baseline level of Medicare payment. And then we get to take advantage of special pay programs on top of that, things like 340B or facility fees. That 76% is with all of that baked in, which means that if we take away facility fees, for example, the gap is only going to widen and create additional challenges for us. We talked earlier about what it means to support these physicians, and these are the numbers that we're faced with. This is the loss on employing a physician in our system on a regular basis. We take a massive loss on every employed physician within our system. And then we effectually recover that through downstream revenue in the hospitals. It's a crazy system that we've been dealing with in this country for almost as long as we've had modern healthcare. It doesn't make any sense, but this is what we do. And we've expanded our physician services dramatically, and it's at this point in which I need to stop and owe each and every one of you and all of your family members and all of your employees an apology for the challenges around accessing care. We recognize we've got huge challenges around accessing care, and we are working hard to figure some of that out, including rapid deployment of telehealth, working on ways to reduce the administrative burden of our physicians and APPs, improving throughput through some of our bottlenecks within our system, and yes, by recruiting more physicians and APPs. This year, we're recruiting a total of 30 physicians and APPs for primary care just in Portland. But look at the impact of that, particularly early on before we start to see the downstream beginning to accrue. It's a huge investment for us, with big brackets around it. But we recognize we have to do that because we are that type of healthcare system. And at the same time, we're fortunate in that we have a lot of assets that I think will help us continue to create an effective and sustainable healthcare system for the future. And that includes our education, it includes our innovation, and I'm going to show you a quick video to talk about that.
If you really believe that you have an idea that can improve patient care, improve quality of life, build support through teamwork. Don't feel like you have to do it alone.
I happen to be a diabetic that needs her eyes checked frequently.
We had 1,300 diabetic patients in our practice.
There's not a lot of options around here in this area for eye doctors.
I would have to drive 40 minutes or so to Auburn to have my eyes dilated.
Hi there.
not an easy accomplishment.
Year after year, over 500 people are not being screened for diabetic retinopathy, which is the leading cause of preventable blindness. That care was not being delivered, and so we had to find a new way to make that happen.
And our clinician has an idea. Of course, they have a really busy practice, and their plate is completely full. We're really there to say from the very beginning, like, okay, how can we shape this idea to be realistic?
Our team came up with the idea of using artificial intelligence-assisted point-of-care screening in primary care for diabetic retinopathy.
I was a little nervous at first because it was new, but now looking back, it was easier than I thought it would be.
I got an email and the Innovation Center was offering these Ignite funds, so we said, perfect, let's apply.
People are really excited to collaborate and support clinicians working in rural areas.
We had to go down to Maine Med and do a presentation in sort of a Shark Tank format. They liked the idea. They actually funded our project fully.
I was at an appointment and he said, oh, by the way, I have this new machine. I'd like for you to try it out. I said, okay.
We're going to bring here today.
We've done at least 200 screenings, and out of those 200, we have found 40-something patients with positive diabetic retinopathy.
It takes 5 minutes to take the images. We get it done right when they're here.
The eye does not have to be dilated. The results are available within 1 to 3 seconds once the image is captured, and then refer the appropriate people that need further care.
So he's white.
When the eye doctor said, you've got a small window of opportunity before you go blind at 43 years old, that was it for me.
That's the most inspiring to me, to see a simple screening measure really prompt someone to make lifestyle changes.
There's a really good chance that it's gonna sort of take off, and that a lot of other rural settings are gonna be excited to implement the same tool.
To be able to do something in a positive way, and it's, you know, having a positive effect on the patient, it's a good feeling.
We lead the health system now, just recently, at almost 70% screening rate. I wanna be at 100%. Part of the excitement is that this is a scalable technology, and really a benefit in terms of quality of life for vision saved, which is huge and almost unmeasurable.
I couldn't be more grateful. It's definitely benefited my life, and it's all because of Dr. Nolan.
Example of the innovation that we're undertaking to think about how we transform care. And while he doesn't say it explicitly up there, this helps reduce cost. And this was born from the research institute that exists here in Portland. And of course, Maine Medical Center has been the clinical and economic engine for our system and will continue to be. But you can see the benefits don't lie just here in Portland. We're taking them across our system. That's part of the benefit of us being a single system. We have the most amazing care team on the planet, and while I'm a bit biased, it's not just my opinion. Our magnet designation for our nurses at Maine Medical Center reflect that. And I think it's no coincidence that Maine Health, who plays a large role in the state, is proud that the state of Maine was named Leapfrog's safest state of the decade across the entire United States, which I think reflects some of the decision-making that has existed at Maine Health for decades. Many of you have probably benefited or know someone who benefited from some of the advanced care and treatment that occurs. This is an open heart surgery being performed here at Maine Medical Center. And this type of care does require investment. And one of the most tangible evidence of that you're going to see in the upcoming months is the new Malone Family Tower as part of the master facility plan at Maine Medical Center. It's going to give us more ability to provide greater access and care, and it's going to create a much better experience for both our workforce and all of you as patients. And then I want to leave on a couple of high notes. I want to talk about that working together one more time, because those two words are so critically important. We recognize this vision is way too aspirational for us to achieve alone. It's going to take all of us working together, and we want to invite anyone who wants to be on this journey with us to achieve this cause. And we are so grateful for many of those partnerships. You saw an image of some of the vaccinations that occurred after the pandemic that involved many of your employees volunteering to be a part of that effort with us, and we are so grateful for that kind of partnership. We have opened food pantries across our system, providing emergency food relief and sustainable food relief in our Food as Medicine program with many of you, such as Hannafer's and Good Shepherd and Wayside Kitchens. And we're grateful for those types of partnerships. And we're going to need more of those in the future. We've engaged in conversations with many of you. We'll want to continue that dialogue to understand how we can best put our healthcare resources, our limited healthcare resources, to the best uses in the communities we serve. Thank you all. I'll stop here, and I think we have some time maybe for a few questions. We'll open it up to questions. Yes, up here. I think we've got a microphone coming for you.
Thank you, Tommy. I'm Elizabeth Ross Holmstrom, and I am with Mindful Employer, but I have a 20-year history in the health and well-being space, the insurance side, relationship management with Maine Health and Anthem, and then a large bank where I managed $500 million budget for healthcare. Sure. And my curiosity is that in these conversations, we're talking about systems, mm-hmm. right? And in the systems, I believe that one of the gaps that we haven't been talking about is root cause. So we know, and you mentioned it at the very end, food, loving community, nature, plants, those things are the things that lead to well-being,
for sure.
right? So how do we, as a community, we live in one of the most resource abundant, natural resource abundant states, right? We have a beautiful collection of human beings who are smart and loving and care about this community. How do we start this conversation around flipping this system around so that we fund a wing at the hospital that's focused on community care and well-being? Lisa Sakabason at the Wabanaki Health System is doing beautiful work. So just wonder if you can talk about that.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's a both and. So I don't think it's an either or. We're still going to have significant healthcare needs in our community that are going to need to be met, particularly as the population continues to age. Part of what makes delivering healthcare so difficult right now, and part of the challenge that our workforce faces, is that the reality is our population is living past the age at which your heart would kill you. And that's largely because of the proliferation of statin drugs in our country. We're living longer because of that. But now we're living to the age at which our nervous system is failing. Our brain's not functioning the way it used to. We're not able to ambulate and move the way we need to. So we're still going to have a need for healthcare delivery, which is our core business at Maine Health. If you look at the statistics that show our healthcare spend and our outcomes versus other nations, what's not included is a parallel list of the social spending in those countries relative to the outcomes. When you add the two together, you see that our spending combined on healthcare and social services actually puts us far down the list relative to most other nations. So we're going to have to make much bigger investments in those things that impact the social determinants of health. Now, Maine Health, we've done a lot of that. And so we do a lot of that with some of our community programs that, again, some of which are funded, many of which are not, that include things like healthy cooking classes, for example. And one of the benefits, I rounded with one of those classes in Farmington, and one of the benefits that was not necessarily predicted from that class is that many members of those classes are now forming friend groups and, you know, treating loneliness and building that community connection. They're going to work out together at the gym. One of the nurses said, you know, now I see a group of five individuals who are constantly at the gym together because of the bonds they formed. They were able to build the courage to go and do those types of things. So we've all got to figure out ways to partner to do that together. And so we've been partnering with a number of agencies in our community that focus on that. I'm on the Thrive Committee for the United Way of Southern Maine, for example, to figure out ways we can continue to invest those resources. And I think we have to be thoughtful about how we start to shift that balance between just spending money on healthcare results versus being proactive around some of those things around the social determinants. We want to get to that place. We're not going to achieve that. We are doggedly committed to achieving that vision. We won't do that if we don't get to where you're talking about. for sure. So thank you. Yes.
Good morning, Andy. Susan Morris. This morning, I'm finding that the lens I'm using is how we can help more rural communities in Maine thrive. Thank you for sharing your business model. I was wondering how different it would look if we were to take out the three metropolitan areas in Maine and how different the numbers would be. Not asking you to respond to that, but I was thinking if we were today sitting in Millinocket or Stonington, what conversation we might be having. I also love a call to action, which is, I'll get to the question and then love to hear what you have to say. Try not to blab. So what I'm wondering about is that my call to action is, I think it would be great if we all left with something to truly be thinking about what can we be doing today. So given that today I'm thinking about our rural communities, I think we know the challenges that might lie there for delivery of services outside of our metropolitan areas. I'm wondering, does the profile of who we're trying to attract and retain in the medical field in rural communities, is it different? Or what is different about some of the solutions that could be used? Love the, you know, the telehealth and innovation, but specifically, if we're putting on our hats of being elsewhere than Portland and Maine, what could we be doing to improve the healthcare that is provided? Thank you. And yeah. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I didn't mean to cut you off. Thank you for that. And there's a lot to unpack there. So I think you would see, if we didn't have the connection with Maine Medical Center in Portland, I think you would see across the rest of our system what you were seeing with the other healthcare systems in Maine, which is a significant reduction in services. So there are a number of hospitals in rural communities that no longer provide women's services, labor and delivery services, and we're seeing the impact of that, not just at Maine Medical Center, but in some of our rural facilities. It's part of our motivation for not reducing services, why we tried to figure out ways to take every other cost out of the system that we can beyond reducing services and reducing the size of our workforce, because if we're not providing those services, then who else will? But I have to warn you, it's not just our rural communities. There have been significant reductions in healthcare services in the Lewiston Auburn community in Bangor, as those health systems continue to struggle to figure out a way to make ends meet. It is a challenging, challenging environment. I co-chair a national roundtable on rural healthcare. We are the most rural state in the nation as defined by the federal government. All of Northern New England is. And so we are trying to figure out across the country how we meet some of the workforce needs that we're going to have. And I do think that there is still plenty to attract and draw people to rural communities. Some of it's around affordability, some of it is around the sense of really making connections, and some of it is around being able to tangibly feel the impact of your work. And so I think there's a lot that can be done to continue to do that. The other thing that I'm really excited about is our partnerships with the Dartmouth Healthcare System and the University of Vermont Healthcare System. They share a profile that looks very similar to us and that really focuses us on thinking about ways we can continue to attract a workforce to rural Northern New England to help create that level of sustainability that's going to be required. Other questions? Yes.
Good morning. My name is Ninetra Baruta, and I'm coming from United Way of Southern Maine. Mm-hmm. And my question is, first, let me say thank you so much for sharing this idea of healthy communities and also making sure that they can thrive. And that starts with having the economy that can allow those communities to thrive. And while I'm on that, this past year, we saw so many nurses leaving the jobs. And we also saw the country bringing nurses from abroad into the U.S. And as I travel the state of Maine and see what's going on, I also have heard this idea of our nurses not having what they need to keep their jobs. So it goes back to what Elizabeth was saying around systems that are built, but they are not really giving a chance to people who are supposed to benefit. So I will ask, what are we doing to invest in those we have here so that they can continue the job going forward?
For sure. So we've made a number of investments and restructured the way we think about things. So one thing that I think we have done poorly as an industry, not at Maine Health, but as an industry, is thinking about our hospitals as factories and as our patients as widgets or machines to be serviced. And when we do that, we apply complicated problem solving to what aren't complicated problems. What I mean by that is Omar Hassan, our chief quality officer, likes to talk about, there's sort of three ways to think about problems. There's simple problems, and simple problems require simple solutions. A simple problem might be, or a simple system might be something like baking a cake out of a cake box. A complicated problem where you have more inputs and more variable outputs might be something like going to the moon. A complex problem or system is something like raising a child. I think healthcare is complex. We've been treating it as though it's complicated, and we have to change that. And if we're going to change it, then we've got to empower those who are delivering the care to have the flexibility and freedom to do the things that they need to do and they feel is in their best judgment at the moment. And I don't think we've done a good job of that historically. And that's why it's more critical than ever that we have flexibility to give that freedom to them. And we're trying to do that. We've changed the way we approach organizing ourselves as a system to empower people closer to the front lines where care is being delivered. We've made big investments in reducing the span of control of leaders. So we've gone from 120 direct reports to a nursing manager to break that up into more manageable 40. So they can get more supervision and feedback. We've created programs that provide additional training and support once they've joined us so they can feel safer in delivering the care that they need to. And let's not forget that when we talk about investments, we've made over $330 million of pay increases to our workforce just in the last 2 years to make sure that they're being paid competitively and fairly to ensure that they're able to do the things that they need to do. Part of the investments we'll need to continue to make will be in things like technology and our facilities, like the Malone Family Tower that's coming. So we are continuing to try to think incredibly importantly about how we do that. And just to help drive this home, I think about our organization having four critical functions. One of those is care delivery. And so for that, we've got chief physician officers. Part of that is our clinic, or is our core operations, and for that we have our chief operating officer. Part of that is finance and strategy, and for that we have a chief financial officer. But the most important of all, in my mind, is our people, and for that we have a chief people officer, and he reports directly to me because of the importance of our workforce. If we don't take care of our workforce and sustain them, the rest doesn't matter. And so it really starts there. Thank you for that. Other questions?
Hi, my name is Daniel Grayson with SMCC. You talked about in your talk a variety of levels of providers from CNAs up to physicians. And obviously, all of those have things they're legally allowed to do. If you could make any changes to the practice rules of who can do what would you change?
You know, I don't know what I would change, but what I would tell you is I think that we need to change the way we've approached healthcare, and that I think too often we have viewed it that we need to ultimately have a patient somehow connect with a physician to create an action. I think we've opened our minds to the notion that it often doesn't need to be the physician, it can be an APP. So for example, we've deployed a ton of team-based care across our primary care practices to expand the opportunities to utilize APPs to help us deliver care. But I think we have to go even further. And I think we have to go even further to take the physician away from being the court of highest authority to being the court of last resort. It doesn't mean our physicians aren't important. They will always be critically, critically important to our future. But I think we have to have every single person on the care team owning the problem with the patient and trying to solve it at their level to the degree that they can. And I'm not sure we've always embraced that in healthcare. So I think that's where we have to start thinking about where we can start making changes as much around attitude in addition to regulation.
We have time for one more question.
We have one. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Nicole Esposito. I'm a fifth generation Mainer. I represent the working and middle class here in Maine. I work in oncology, non-clinical, specifically lung. And my question to you is, how are you working with MaineCare and Medicaid, which represents a large patient population here, in preventative screening? For me, I know that 6% of lung cancer patients are screened here in the state of Maine, as opposed to 46% in breast and even more in colorectal. We need to do better, especially because we have a population that is included in the smoking belt, but not just oncology, not just cancer, other screenings and preventative services that are not covered by MaineCare or Medicaid.
Yeah. So for sure, we've got huge opportunities around that. One of the things that we've begun doing is really focusing. We started, admittedly, with our Medicare population, partly because of the opportunity there with the size of the population. And we've made great strides this last year in particular in closing gaps in care. We see that as a huge opportunity. So I'm in a unique position as a healthcare leader because we don't need any more patients. We don't need any more patients in our hospitals. We don't need any more patients in our emergency rooms because we don't have the capacity to meet all of the demand that exists today. So we've got to be focused on how do we keep people out of the hospitals? How do we keep people out of the emergency room? And frankly, it's just the right thing to do regardless of how we're paid. It's what we should be focused on and doing. So we've started that effort and we've been able to see this year, we're starting to see a slight reduction in ER visits per thousand and admissions per thousand in those populations where we've really been focused on this effort. Now I think we've got the opportunities to think about how we expand that across the board. One thing that I'll tell you is, and this is where we may have to reshape our thinking a bit as we think about the future, is we have taken a one size fits all to providing care. And I think increasingly we're beginning to see that even though we get paid different, for different groups of patients, for those on Medicare, those on MaineCare, those with commercial insurance, their needs are actually different. And that we may have to think about focusing our care intentionally to best serve each of those populations, not to create, you know, lack of equity around the care, but actually to provide better care than we've been doing with a one-size-fits-all approach. And we're having some of those conversations internally today to figure that out. Thank you for your time this morning. It's been great to be here with all of you, and I look forward to seeing you again at future events.